Ms. Corson, 08-2094 and 2675, Corson and Alvarez. For the appellants, Ms. Winslow.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
A conspiracy is more than an abstract agreement. Proof of a conspiracy by the government requires more than expressions of interest or even a mere assent between the defendants of the case and the cooperating individual, or, in this case, the undercover agent. The government's burden is to prove that the defendants amongst themselves agreed with each other to commit a criminal act and that they intended to commit that criminal act. Proof of association, mere presence, or even simply speech is inadequate. In this case, the government charged the defendants, three defendants, two which have appealed, with a conspiring to possess with intent to distribute kilograms of cocaine and to interrupt commerce by means of robbery using force and violence. But the government failed to offer any evidence, Your Honors, that there was an actual agreement between the parties. The government's case on appeal, just as in the district court, rested solely on taped conversations between the defendants and an undercover agent and a cooperating individual. There's, I think, no dispute between the parties that those conversations included some shocking, offensive, certainly ill-advised language with the defendants. But nothing in those conversations, or more importantly, in the defendant's conduct in this case, supports an inference by the jury, any reasonable jury, that there was in fact an agreement amongst the defendants themselves to commit the underlying acts, the criminal acts that were proposed.
The drug conspiracy count doesn't require the proof of an overt act. Would you contend that the Hobbs Act conspiracy does require proof of an overt act?
Judge, with all due respect, I take some issue with this blanket statement that there is no overt act requirement. The cases cited by the government, and I'll address some of them individually, do certainly make that statement that there's no overt act requirement. That's really a pleading requirement to which the cases are referring to. The government is not required to charge an overt act or substantial step. But nonetheless, if you look at the cases, and some that are cited by the government specifically, I'll refer to United States versus Dominguez, a case that the government relies upon heavily, in which this court held that there was no overt act requirement. In that case, the court went on at length, several pages, discussing the negotiations that occurred for the transaction, samples of drugs that were provided, introductions between various conspirators and co-conspirators that were accomplished, and the underlying holding of that case, I don't believe, supports this blanket statement that the government has relied upon that no overt act is required. No overt act need be charged. Nonetheless, the government must prove by some conduct of the defendants that there was the intent to commit these crimes. So the question, and I think this is the question, again, with all due respect, that this court has not resolved, is whether pure speech is sufficient to prove defendants' intent to commit the underlying crime. So I apologize if that didn't answer.
Well, is there any difference then between what's required to be proved for the Hobbs Act conspiracy and the drug conspiracy in terms of an overt act?
No. I think, as a strict matter, no, that there isn't. But I do submit to Your Honor that, to the court, that it is not sufficient to charge and prove a conspiracy case simply on the basis of speech. That the defendants may have had conversations in the presence of cooperating individuals and undercover agents, expressed an assent, expressed an interest, or even expressed that they were individually willing to commit these crimes, does not meet the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendants amongst themselves actually intended to commit the underlying act.
But then they did show up at this parking lot on the designated day.
November 28th, yes.
Supposed to happen.
I'm glad Your Honor brought that to, offers me the opportunity to answer that question. The evidence in the record, again, on this point is not terribly disputed, that, in fact, on November 27th, a telephone call was made to Mr. Marcus Corson, telling him that this deal, this fictional stash house robbery, was going to occur the next day, November 28th. And they had all been informed at some previous time that they were to take the day off of work, whatever day this was going to occur. Again, the record is clear and undisputed that during the day of November 28th, multiple phone calls were made from the cooperating individual to Marcus Corson's cellular telephone that he did not answer and ultimately did answer, informed the cooperating individual that he was at work. In fact, he had gone to work. He later told the cooperating individual, and I quote from the transcript, "I don't want to see dude again," meaning the undercover agent, undercover officer. And then what followed between that conversation, well, shortly after that, he received another phone call from the cooperating individual. Marcus Corson responded that he was, quote, straight, hung up the phone, didn't want to speak to them again. What followed then was a series of unrecorded phone calls between the undercover, or the, pardon me, the cooperating individual and Marcus Corson. After a lengthy series of phone conversations, phone calls which far exceeded the allotted hour that they were supposed to have to meet and accomplish this robbery, Marcus Corson, Oscar Alvarez, and Aaron Corson did arrive in the parking lot without any evidence of the means to commit this robbery. So what's clear is that although they did show up in the I'd be happy to address that issue, Judge, but when they showed up at this parking lot, their clear intent was to stop these phone calls to get the undercover agent or undercover cooperating individual, I don't want to confuse these two people, to stop calling them. They didn't engage him in any preparations for this robbery. And with respect to this mythical firearm that the government suggests may have been in the trunk of the car, may have been in the glove compartment, that is mere speculation, pure speculation, and poorly founded speculation. The government, when your honors read the transcripts of these tapes, they are transcripts that were prepared by the government. So we have the word two, strapped two, a question to the...
And your clients didn't have alternate versions prepared, correct?
We did not have alternate versions prepared, but Mr. Blagan, on behalf of Oscar Alvarez, argued this point to the jury very clearly. Obviously, the jury is instructed that it is the audio tapes and not the transcripts that are evidence.
So the jury makes that decision, don't they, whether it's strapped also or strapped to, as kind of a general question?
That's correct, Your Honor. They do make that. They do make that determination. Nonetheless, pure speculation, even if the jury were to agree with speculation, is insufficient. And this court has the obligation to reverse the conviction if it's based solely on speculation. May I address the strap two comment?
You may.
Thank you.
But you say that it was the clear intent to end the phone calls. That was
end the phone calls.
What do you get from the conversation where they say they're pretty explicit in what they say, but it's not stop calling us, don't call us again?
Well, Your Honor, that point is not in fact clear because there is this series of unrecorded phone calls that have occurred between the undercover, cooperating individual and Marcus Corson. Those phone calls were not recorded.
No evidence that anything was said about stop calling me.
There was no evidence as to anything that was said at all.
Get to your strap two.
Thank you, Your Honor. Strap two, Mr. Blagan submitted, the defense submitted, was a phrase meaning strapped, attached to, if you will, as opposed to strapped also, armed also. This particular interpretation of strapped to phrase takes on additional strength when one looks at page 5 of the government's appendix, in which Marcus Corson, in a previous and unrelated conversation, uses the phrase strapped to discuss being armed in general, discussing that the cartel members, the drug cartel members, would be strapped to. Nothing in that conversation would support a finding or a conclusion that he was, in fact, at that time strapped, thus supporting a strapped also. So I think read in context, using a principle of statutory construction, if you will, well, phrase is given the same meaning and takes on the same meaning it used in every context.
Okay. Did you want to save some time?
Yes, Your Honor, I would. Thank you.
And for the government, Mr. Thompson?
May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Joe Thompson, and I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the United States. There was sufficient evidence here for a rational jury to find the defendants guilty of the charged conspiracies. At trial, the government presented a series of recorded conversations during which the defendants repeatedly and expressly agreed to commit the Stash House robbery. During these conversations, the defendants discussed at length their plan for robbing the Stash House. They discussed how they're going to split the proceeds of the Stash House robbery, and they expressed a willingness to kill if necessary in the course of the robbery.
Could I just ask a preliminary thing? I'm just not familiar with this. You have a fake, disgruntled drug dealer and a drug house that does not exist. You've got a confidential informant who's sent out to, I guess, find people who might want to rob the drug house. Who were they after? Is this a common way just to kind of troll until you find somebody that might want to commit this crime?
In this case, the ATF, yes, it was a fake stash house, a sting operation that the ATF set up.
But usually they're targeting to catch somebody, in particular. Is it just you're just going out in the street until you find somebody that might be interested in robbing it?
Well, in this case, it's not in the record, the details of how they picked him. However, clearly in this case, the CI picked right, because immediately when he presented the opportunity to the defendants, they jumped at it.
But the CI brought these three defendants to ATF. ATF didn't say, do you know anything about these three guys?
That's correct. The CI said these three guys would be interested in robbing a stash house, and then he presented them in a wired conversation the opportunity of a business proposition on what he called a business proposition on November 8th,
yeah,
before he even explained
it. 4 or 5 kilograms of cocaine, so that's attractive. Nobody seems to be raising that. I just find it kind of, I don't know, unusual. Maybe I just haven't been around enough. Go ahead.
Well, getting back to when the CI initially presented the opportunity to the defendants on November 8th, he, like I said, he mentioned a business proposition involving an acquaintance of his who was involved in a drug trafficking organization. And he said he had been running security for this individual. And before he even could say any more, the defendants immediately guessed that he was talking about a robbery. And they jumped at it. They expressed enthusiasm. In fact, you know, they said they pressed him for details. They asked him, what are you talking about exactly? Are you talking about a gank, a robbery? They said they were interested. Their only concern would be whether the drugs would be there. And the CI told them, the drugs will be there. Don't worry. And after he did, they immediately said, we're in. Oscar Alvarez said, we in it 100%. Marcus Corsa said, I'm down. And Marcus Corsa not only said that he's down, he said his brother, Aaron, would be down too. He said they would be a three-man crew. So Marcus actually, far from not having taken any overt act in furtherance here, he actually recruits his brother to be the third member of their crew, their robbery crew. And they agree on November 8th that they'll meet again, and they do. In fact, all three of them meet then on November 20th. Both Marcus Corson and Oscar Alvarez, and Marcus's brother, who had recruited into the crew, and they meet with the undercover agent and the CI. And during this meeting, they discuss the robbery plan at length. They discuss how they're going to split the chop or the proceeds of the robbery. The defendants expressed, they said they're going to bring firearms. There's a long discussion about whether the people at the stash house will be armed. And they agree they probably will be, and the defendants say that's not a problem. We'll be armed too. In fact, we'll have bigger guns, and we'll go in there. And if things go down the wrong way, we're willing to kill if necessary. We'll go in blazing, they say. And on the November 20th, the undercover agent gives them an opportunity to back out, to withdraw. He asks them, you know, if you guys aren't interested, that's okay. I'll find another crew. Just let me know. Series of times, and to the contrary, they don't back down. They express their interest enthusiastically. Aaron Corson, who's not a party to this appeal, says, who the heck ain't going to move on 15 keys? He says, signed, sealed, done deal. Marcus Corson immediately afterwards agrees, says, man, it's on, dog. And Oscar Alvarez says, we the go-to team. It's all good. They're excited about this deal. And at the end of the meeting on the 20th, which goes on for some time, they discuss how it's going to work, and the undercover tells him he'll call them, give them 24 hours notice before the robbery. And they said, well, they'll be ready to go. They'll drop anything. Aaron Corson calls it the president hotline. You call, we drop everything. And that's what happens on the 28th. They get the call, and this call's on the 27th and the 28th, and they show up on the 28th. And it's true, they didn't go through with it on the 28th. But they showed up, and when they got there, in fact, and this is strong evidence of their intent, I think the fact that they show up to the final staging area of the robbery to await the final call in the location of the stash house, they showed up that day, and that's strong evidence of their intent to carry out the crime. And
in fact, how do you feel about the overt act issue I asked about? Do you think 1951 conspiracy requires proof of an overt act?
No, as you said, as the cases cited in our case say, we do not believe they do. And in fact, this has been an undisputed issue throughout the trial. I don't believe that defense has ever suggested that an overt act was required.
If you had to prove one, was there an overt act?
Well, in this case, I think there was. They showed up to the final staging area of the robbery. Yes. And not only that, they show up, but when they get there, they talk about how they're going to do the robbery. Immediately when they get there, they discuss the possible location of the stash house, which of the suburbs, the western suburbs it might be in. Then they discuss their plan. They discuss who the CI is going to ride with. And they conclude he's going to ride in a car with the undercover agent, and the defendants will follow in a separate car to the stash house. Again, this is strong evidence from which the jury could conclude that they intended to commit the stash house agreement. And it comes at the end of a series of pair of conversations on November 8th and November 20th, in which the defendants expressly, repeatedly, and enthusiastically agree to commit the stash house robbery.
Well, since there isn't any real stash house, what would have been the time for the arrest? They followed to go someplace and stopped? Or?
That was the initial operation plan called for them to travel from the parking lot, the final staging area on the 28th, to a different location and commit and make the arrest there.
If they went to the different location and whatever they were going to do to get out, and I don't know what they were going to do. I don't think they did either. Then they arrest them. Is that right?
That's correct. As far as the details of the takedown, that's not on the record. But
didn't get there.
They didn't get to that point. That's correct. They did withdraw at the last minute. I should note that when they do withdraw on the 28th, previously they expressed some concern about possible surveillance. One of the defendants complains that their car sticks out too much in the parking lot. They do what is called a heat run. They drive around the parking lot looking for possible surveillance from law enforcement. And in fact, they asked the CI if it's possible that if the drug trafficking organization had ever followed them before, just to guard against any such robbery. Again, the defendant's words, obviously on November 8th, the 20th, and on the 28th, strong evidence of their agreement and intent to rob the stash house. And in addition, their actions, the fact that they. After the 28th, Marcus Corson brings his brother in, and all three defendants meet with the undercover agent and the CI on the 20th. And then again, even more strongly, the fact that on the November 28th, they show up to the final staging area to await the call from the undercover and the location of the stash house. If the court has no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the defendant's convictions.
Right, thank you. And how much time does Ms. Winslow have? 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. To begin with, the government said that in this case, the ATF and the confidential informant chose correctly when they picked these individuals to commit this crime, and I submit that they chose very wrong. In fact, they chose three individuals who made the decision not to arm themselves and to show up to commit this robbery. In fact,
how do we know that they didn't arm themselves?
Judge, there's no evidence in the record to suggest that they did. I submit that the strap 2 is pure speculation.
Strap 2, some evidence.
I submit a speculation, but the fact is, at the end of the meeting on the 28th in the parking lot, they told the confidential informant that they would be back around. They left the parking lot. That was clearly a lie. They clearly wanted to get away from the confidential informant. They did not intend to commit this robbery. And Your Honor's question or statement, I think, is well taken, that, in fact, they didn't know what they were going to do. The record in this case is replete with comments by the undercover agent that they didn't know what the plan is. They didn't know where they were to meet. They didn't know how this was going to go down. In fact, the details had never been worked out in this particular instance.
How old are these people?
They are in their early 20s, Judge, very early 20s. There was one meeting. I see I'm out of time. If I could just finish this.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. There was one meeting only between all of these individuals, the undercover agent and the confidential informant, one meeting only between all parties. That was on November the 20th. November 20th is the one and only time these individuals ever met to discuss this matter. It's in the record over and over again that the group of them met, got into the back of a van, smoked a substantial amount of marijuana, and had a conversation that they are, I believe, sorely regretting now. After that conversation, there was never an attempt by any of these defendants to contact the undercover agent or the confidential informant, and no further efforts on their behalf to further this robbery attempt. If Your Honors have no further questions, I would ask that this case be reversed, vacated.
All right. Thank you. And I want to thank both defense counsel who served as appointed counsel in this case, if I understand correctly, in representing your clients in the highest tradition of the bar. It's a great service to the court. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. And the last case set for the